We're going to remember white South African newspaper editor and anti-apartheid activist Donald Woods. He died yesterday of cancer at the age of 67. He became an enemy of the government in the 70s, taking an anti-apartheid stand in his paper, The Daily Dispatch. Woods was a friend of Stephen Biko, the leader of the South African Students' Organization, an all-black group at the forefront of the black consciousness movement. Biko died in prison in 1977 from a beating at the hands of South African police. After Woods led the call for an investigation into Biko's death, he was placed under a 5-year banning order. Woods fled the country and lived in exile in England. His friendship with Biko is dramatized in the film Cry Freedom, with Kevin Kline as Woods and Denzel Washington as Biko. I spoke with Donald Woods in 1987.
You met Stephen Biko in, I think it was 1973.
Yeah.
How did you first meet him, and what was he doing at the time?
He was leader of the Black Consciousness Movement, but he was under a restriction. He had to stay in his house and not talk to more than one person at a time. And ironically, the same restriction I later got. And in fact, I used to attack him and his movement in my newspaper because I considered them too radical. And I also thought that their response to apartheid was xenophobic because it was blacks, you know, down it, to hell with the whites, the blacks must do this. And even the liberal whites are in the way. So I thought this was racist and I called it apartheid in reverse. And one of his associates came into my office and said if I had any sense of fairness, I would go and see him because what I was writing was inaccurate. So I went to see him, and I found that what I had been writing was inaccurate, that black consciousness wasn't racism. It was an affirmation that blacks had to acquire the psychological liberation from apartheid and to assume the leadership of their own liberation, which is entirely legitimate. So from then on, we became friends.
Were there examples that he gave you that made you come around to that point of view?
No, I think it was just being with him and discussing all these issues. He had such an impressive intellect, and he himself, you had to be with him only about 20 minutes to know there was not a scrap of racism in him. And he had white friends, you know.
What kind of things did you write in your column in support of the work that he was doing?
Basically trying to explain to other whites in South Africa why this was not a threat, and on the contrary, that we had to dismantle apartheid entirely and actually follow black leadership into a black-dominated republic. Democratic, but obviously black-dominated because in South Africa, 5 out of every 6 people are black. And if you have a democracy, that's you're going to end up with a, you know, black-led government, which is fine.
Stephen Biko was arrested for, I guess it was the fourth time in 1977, and he died after being tortured and beaten. I think the death resulted directly from brain injuries from the beating that he received. The authorities told you what?
Well, they told the country that they implied that he died of hunger strike.
Did you believe that?
Not for a minute, no, because his wife and I went and we had quite a long search before we were able to see the body. We found it in a little morgue in King Williamstown, and when we saw his body, we knew, obviously, but we'd known anyway, that he wouldn't have gone on hunger strike. And then I managed to get hold of, by means I can't ever be too explicit about, medical evidence, a pathologist report after his body, after post-mortem, and this proved that he'd been assaulted and had died of blows to the head. So I published this and was arrested shortly after.
Did he ever tell you that he'd never do anything like go on a hunger strike?
Yes, we once had a discussion, and neither of us thought it would ever come to pass, but you know, so many dissidents had died in jails. And I said, he said, if they ever claim I hanged myself or strangled myself or starved myself, you are to know it's a lie. In effect, raise hell, you know.
So he expected that something like this might be pulled at some point.
I don't think he did, but he just said academically, if it ever should happen. And in fact, I don't think the South African government ever wanted him killed. What happened with Biko was they feared him very much and they wanted him locked up. But the Port Elizabeth security police were particularly notorious in their brutality. And they beat him up and they went too far. And I know the government got a terrible fright, the members of the cabinet, because they knew this was big trouble. And indeed it was. They've never really recovered. You know, the name Biko haunts them up until this day. And I think it'll go on doing so.
For those reasons, did you think that he would be comparatively safe in prison, that they wouldn't kill him because of the backlash that
he and I both thought that was the probability, but that there's always the possibility of the other.
How did you find out about his death?
My secretary told me. I got into the office one morning and she said there'd been a phone call from his family. And I just disbelieved it. I said, no, even this government's not that stupid. Must be a mistake. Then I found it was true.
What did you do?
I don't know. It was such a mixture of grief and anger, you know. I immediately went to a number of cities and made speeches of accusation and published a lot of angry editorials and joined his other friends who were demonstrating or, you know, condemning what had happened.
Did you think that there would be a greater crackdown on you because of your outspokenness about his death?
At that time, I wasn't thinking of such a thing. It didn't matter. You know, when you're really angry, you don't think much of that. And in particular, I wanted to put the heat on their embassies in America and Britain and Europe. So what I did was send a lot of stuff to the press. I sent pictures of his body out, and I sent articles out about him and about his death. And these were used all over the world to the South African government. In fact, that's why they got pressured into having a kind of inquest.
How soon did the banning order come after Biko's death?
Well, he died on September the 12th, 1977, and I was banned on October the 19th.
What were you doing when they presented the banning order to you?
I was about to get on a plane in Johannesburg, and three of them stepped up.
Three
security officers. And they asked me to come with them and handed me this long list of documents signed by the Minister of Police. And that's all the different restrictions. Like, you, from now on, for 5 years, you've got to stay at home. You can't talk to more than one person at a time. You can't be in a room with more than one person at a time. You can't write anything, not even a diary or postcard. You can't be quoted in the press. It's a whole range of restrictions like that.
You started writing a book about Stephen Biko shortly after you were banned.
Yes.
How did you hide the manuscript?
I hid it in a record album, an Ed Murrow recording of the speeches of Winston Churchill. I thought that was appropriate. And it was in among hundreds of other records, so they would have had a job finding that one.
We're listening back to a 1987 interview with Donald Woods. He died yesterday at the age of 67. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1987 interview with white South African newspaper editor and anti-apartheid activist Donald Woods. He fled the country after he was placed under a banning order in 1977. Woods died yesterday at the age of 67. Why did you want to escape and leave South Africa? It was a 5-year banning order.
The main motive was to, I'd promised Steve Biko that if he got killed like this, I'd raise as much hell as possible. Also, it was my natural inclination to do that then, because I had such a feeling of, people very kindly call it courage, but it isn't, it's indignation. You get so indignant that you feel you've got to do something, and the more you can do, the better. And I knew that by sitting quietly in my house, I couldn't cause them any problems. Whereas if I could get to New York or London, there's no end of prospects of hassling the embassies there.
How did you plan out your escape? You probably figured
badly.
You were being monitored,
badly,
right?
Yes. The plan we cooked up was actually terribly amateurish. And it's really almost a miracle that it worked, because so many things went wrong and nearly went wrong and could have gone wrong. But eventually I got across into Lesotho. I was disguised as a priest and my hair was dyed black. I looked quite different to what I normally looked like.
What did you do to make yourself look like a priest?
Well, my wife dyed my hair black, and through methods which, even to this day, I wouldn't like to implicate anyone by disclosing, I borrowed a priest's outfit. And also I had a fallback. Let's just say that I initially planned to wade across the Tiller River, which is a very small river, but
this is the river that separates
South
Africa
from
Lesotho?
Lesotho. But you must realize Lesotho's like is surrounded by South Africa. It's like an enclave inside. But at least if you get in there, they look after you. It's a very brave little black-ruled country. So, but the river was they had 4 days of rain continuously, and so the river was a raging flood. There were bits of tree trunk being whipped past, and I had the manuscript of my Steve Biko book with me, so I certainly couldn't swim across that lot with this thing. And so I had a fallback plan, and that was a fake passport. So eventually I had to bluff my way through the border guards with this fake passport. And that worked.
What did you tell them?
Well, I just said I was saying I had an early mass to say across in quitting. See, fortunately, and this is the reason we chose this little remote border post, there was a Catholic mission called St. Teresa's, just a few miles away. And apparently priests quite often would go through to say mass in Kuting, and Lesotho is a very Catholic country. So that was my, that covered me very well, and that's how I got off.
How were you smuggled out of your house?
I lay on the floor of the car, and my wife put a coat over me, and she backed out right past the security police chap. You know, when they've been watching you for months, they don't sort of look down into the floor of the car. And that's how she got me beyond the city limits. Then I hitchhiked to a point where a friend was arranged to meet me and drive me to the border. She went back and showed a movie for the kids, and over the tapped telephone she gave the impression that I was upstairs asleep. And then the next morning they all left by another route. Now they could get out on ordinary tourist visas, you see. So they got out by another route, and then we all met up in Lesotho. Then we flew out in a tiny plane across South African territory for 2.5 hours into Botswana. And before we took off, we had threats from the South African government that they'd force the plane down if we tried to fly across. But that they were just bluffing. They were trying to intimidate us.
Your goal once gaining freedom was to continue to publicize what had happened to Stephen Biko and to continue to fight against apartheid. What were the most effective means you had for doing that, living in exile?
Oh, terrific opportunities. You can really cost the South African government literally millions by... You see, every time a program like this happens, that we're talking on now, the South African embassies and consulates go into a little minor frenzy and they say, how do we counter this? And so that ties them up a bit more. Sometimes in the early stages they were suckered into confrontations on television, and they soon stopped that. Then you help put pressure on their position at the UN and in their embassies by publishing through broadcasts or newspaper articles exactly what they're doing there. And they find it very hard to answer because these are facts.
Donald Woods, recorded in 1987. He died of cancer yesterday in England at the age of 67.